This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Another Man's Moccasins by Craig Johnson, narrated by George Guidel, and directed by Matt Wilson. This book is copyrighted 2008 by Craig Johnson. This recording is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books. The author opens this novel with an old Indian prayer. Great Spirit, grant that I may not criticize my neighbor until I have walked a mile in his moccasins. And now, Another Man's Moccasins.
Chapter 1. Two more. Katie looked at me, but didn't say anything. It had been like this for the last week. We'd reached a plateau, and she was satisfied with the progress she'd made. I wasn't. The physical therapist at University of Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia had warned me that this might happen. It wasn't that my daughter was weak or lazy. It was far worse than that. She was bored. Two more?
I heard you.
She plucked at her shorts and avoided my eyes.
Your voice, it carries.
I placed an elbow on my knee, chin on fist, sat farther back on the sit-up bench, and glanced around. We weren't alone. There was a kid in a Durant quarterback club T-shirt who was trying to bulk up his 145-pound frame at one of the Universal machines. I'm not sure why he was up here. There were no televisions, and it wasn't as fancy as the main gym downstairs. I understood all the machines up here. You didn't have to plug any of them in. But I wondered about him. It could be that he was here because of Katie. Two more.
Piss off.
The kid snickered, and I looked at him. I glanced back at my daughter. This was good. Anger sometimes got her to finish up, even if it cost me the luxury of conversation for the rest of the evening. It didn't matter tonight. She had a dinner date, and then had to be home for an important phone call. I had zip. I had all the time in the world. She had cut her auburn hair short to match the spot where they had made the U-shaped incision that had allowed her swelling brain to survive. Only a small scar was visible at the hairline. She was beautiful, and the pain in the ass was that she knew it. It got her pretty much whatever she wanted. Beauty was life's easy pass. I was lucky I got to ride on the shoulder. Two more? She picked up her water bottle and squeezed out a gulp, leveling the cool eyes back on me. We sat there, looking at each other, both of us dressed in gray. She stretched a finger out and pulled the band of my T-shirt down, grazing a fingernail on my exposed collarbone.
That one?
Just because she was beautiful didn't mean she wasn't smart. Diversion was another of her tactics. I had enough scars to divert the entire First Division. She had known this scar and had seen it on numerous occasions. Her question was a symptom of the memory loss that Dr. Rissman had mentioned. She continued to poke my shoulder with the finger.
That one.
Two more.
That one?
Katie never gave up. It was a family trait, and in our tiny family, stories were the coinage of choice, a bartering in the aesthetic of information and the athletics of emotion. So I answered her. Tet. She set her water bottle down on the rubber-padded floor.
When?
Before you were born. She lowered her head and looked at me through her lashes, one cheek pulled up in a half-smile.
Things happened before I was born?
Well, nothing really important. She took a deep breath, gripped the sides of the bench, and put all her effort into straightening the lever action of 30 pounds at her legs. Slowly, the weights lifted to the limit of the movement and then, just as slowly, dropped back. After a moment, she caught her breath.
Marine inspector, right?
I nodded. Yep.
Why Marines?
It was Vietnam, and I was going to be drafted. So it was a choice. I was consistently amazed at what her damaged brain chose to remember.
What was Vietnam like?
Confusing, but I got to meet Martha Ray. Unsatisfied with my response, she continued to study my scar.
You don't have any tattoos.
No, I sighed, just to let her know that her tactics weren't working.
I have a tattoo.
You have two. I cleared my throat in an attempt to end the conversation. She pulled up the cap sleeve of her Philadelphia City Sports t-shirt, exposing the faded Cheyenne turtle totem on her shoulder. She was probably unaware that she'd been having treatments to have it removed. It had been the ex-boyfriend's idea, all before the accident. The other one's on your butt, but we don't have to look for it now. The kid snickered again. I turned and stared at him with a little more emphasis this time.
Bear was in Vietnam with you, right?
She was smiling as I turned back to her. All the women in my life smiled when they talked about Henry Standing Bear. It was a bit annoying, but Henry was my best and lifelong friend, so I got over it. He owned the Red Pony, a bar on the edge of the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, only a mile from my cabin, and he was the one who was taking Katie to dinner. I wasn't invited. He and my daughter were in cahoots. They had pretty much been in cahoots since she'd been born. Henry was in country, special operations group. We didn't serve together.
What was he like back then?
I thought about it. He's mellowed, a little. It was a frightening thought. Two more? Her gray eyes flashed. One more. I smiled. One more. Katie's slender hands returned to the sides of the bench, and I watched as the toned legs once again levitated and lowered the 30 pounds. I waited a moment, then lumbered up and placed a kiss at the horseshoe-shaped scar and helped her stand. The physical progress was moving ahead swimmingly, mostly due to the advantages of her stellar conditioning and youth. But the afternoon workouts took their toll, and she was usually a little unsteady by the time we finished. I held her hand and picked up her water and tried not to concentrate on the fact that my daughter had been a fast-track, hot-shot lawyer back in Philly only 2 months earlier, and that now she was here in Wyoming and was trying to remember that she had tattoos and how to walk without assistance. We made our way toward the stairwell and the downstairs showers. As we passed the kid at the machine, he looked at Katie admiringly and then at me. "Hey, Sheriff." I paused for a moment and steadied Katie on my arm. "Yep. J.P. said you once bench-pressed 6 plates. I continued looking down at him.
"What?"
He gestured toward the steel plates on the rack at the wall.
"Jerry Pilch, the football coach, he said senior year, before you went to USC, you bench-pressed 6 plates.
He continued to stare at me.
"That's over 300 pounds.
"Yep.
Well, I winked. Jerry's always had a tendency to exaggerate.
"I thought so."
I nodded to the kid and helped Katie down the steps. It had been 8 plates, actually, but that had been a long time ago. My shower was less complicated than Katie's, so I usually got out before her and waited on the bench beside the Clear Creek Bridge. I placed my summer wear palm leaf hat on my head, slipped on my 10-year-old Ray-Bans, and shrugged the workout bag strapped farther onto my shoulder so that it didn't press my Absaroka County Sheriff's star into my chest. I pushed open the glass door and stepped into the perfect fading glory of a High Plains summer afternoon. It was vacation season, creeping up on rodeo weekend, and the streets are full of people from somewhere else. I took a left and started toward the bridge and the bench. I sat next to the large man with the ponytail and placed the gym bag between us. How come I wasn't invited to dinner? The Cheyenne Nation kept his head tilted back, eyes closed, taking in the last warmth of the afternoon sun.
We have discussed this.
It's Saturday night, and I don't have anything to do.
You will find something.
He took a deep breath, the only sign that he wasn't made of wood and selling cigars.
Where's Vic?
Firearms recertification in Douglas.
Damn.
I thought about my scary under-sheriff from Philadelphia, how she could out-shoot, out-drink, and out-swear every cop I knew, and how she was now representing the county at the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy. I was unsure if that was a positive thing. Yep, not a safe weekend to be in Douglas. He nodded almost imperceptibly.
How's all that going?
I took a moment to discern what all that might mean. I'm not really sure. He raised an eyelid and studied me in a myopic fashion. We seemed to be having a problem getting in sync. The eyelid closed, and we sat there as a silence passed. Where are you going to dinner?
I'm not going to tell you.
Come on. His face remained impassive.
We have discussed this.
We had, it was true. The bear had expressed the opinion that for both of our mental healths it might be best if Katie and I didn't spend every waking hour in each other's company. It was difficult, but I was going to have to let her out of my sight sometime. In town or over in Sheridan?
I am not going to tell you.
I was disconcerted by the flash of a camera and turned to see a woman from somewhere else smile and continue down the sidewalk toward the Busy Bee Cafe, where I would likely be having my dinner alone. I turned to look at Henry Standing Bear's striking profile. You should sit with me more often. I'm photogenic.
They were taking photographs with a greater frequency before you arrived.
I ignored him. She's allergic to plums.
Yes.
I'm not sure if she'll remember that.
I do.
No alcohol?
Yes.
I thought about that advisory and came clean. I let her have a glass of red wine last weekend.
I know.
I turned and looked at him. She told you?
Yes.
Cahoots. I had a jealous inkling that the bear was making more progress in drawing all of Katie back to us than I was. I stretched my legs and crossed my boots. They were still badly in need of a little attention. I adjusted my gun belt so that the hammer of my .45 wasn't digging into my side. We still on for the Rotary thing Friday?
Yes.
Rotary was sponsoring a debate between me and prosecuting attorney Kyle Straub. We were the two candidates for the position of Absaroka County Sheriff. After 5 elections and 24 sworn years, I usually did pretty well at debates, but felt a little hometown support might be handy, so I had asked Henry to come. Think of it as a public service. Most Rotarians have never even met a Native American. That finally got the one eye to open again, and he turned toward me.
Would you like me to wear a feather?
No, I'll just introduce you as an Injun. Katie placed her hand on my shoulder and leaned over to allow the Cheyenne Nation to bestow a kiss on her cheek. She was wearing blue jeans and a tank top with, I was pleased to see, the fringed concho-studded leather jacket I'd bought for her years ago. It could still turn brisk on July nights along the foothills of the Bighorn Mountains. She jostled the hat on my head and dropped her gym bag on top of mine. She turned to Henry. Ready? He opened his other eye.
Ready.
He rose effortlessly, and I thought, if I got it in quick, that maybe I'd get an answer. Where you going? She smiled as the bear came around the back of the bench and took her elbow. I'm not allowed to tell you. Katie's current love interest, Vic's younger brother, was supposed to be flying in from Philadelphia on Tuesday for a Wild West vacation. I still hadn't gotten a straight answer as to with whom he was staying. Don't forget that Michael is calling. She shook her head as they walked past me, pausing to lift my hat and plant a kiss on the crown of my head. I know when he's calling, Daddy. I'll be home long before then. She shoved my hat down. Hard. I readjusted and watched as they crossed the sidewalk where Henry helped her into Lola, his powder blue 59 T-Bird convertible. The damage I had done to the classic automobile was completely invisible due to the craftsmanship of the body men in South Philly, and I watched as the Wyoming sun glistened on the Thunderbird's flanks. I had a moment of hope that they wouldn't get going when the starter continued to grind, but the aged Y-block caught and blew a slight fantail of carbon into the street. He slipped her into gear, and they were gone. As usual, I got the gym bags, and he got the girl. I considered my options. There was the plastic-wrapped burrito at the come-and-go, the stuffed peppers at the Durant Home for Assisted Living, a pot pie from the kitchenette back at the jail, or the Busy Bee Cafe. I gathered up my collection of bags and hustled across the bridge over Clear Creek before Dorothy Caldwell changed her mind
and turned the sign, written in cursive, hanging on her door.
Not the usual?
No. She poured my iced tea and looked at me, fist on hip.
You didn't like it last time?
I struggled to remember, but gave up. I don't remember what it was last time.
Is Katie's condition contagious?
I ignored the comment and tried to decide what to order. I'm feeling experimental. Are you still offering your weekend cuisines of the world? It was an attempt on her part to broaden the culinary experience of our little corner of the High Plains.
I am.
Where in the world are we?
Vietnam.
It didn't take me long to respond. I'll pass.
It's really good.
I weaved my fingers and rested my elbows on the counter. What is it?
Chicken with lemongrass.
She continued to look at me. Henry's dish?
That's where I got the recipe.
I withered under her continued gaze. All right. She busied herself in the preparation of the dish, and I sipped my tea. I glanced around at the five other people in the homey cafe, but didn't recognize anyone. I must have been thirsty from watching Katie work out, because a third of the glass was gone in two gulps. I set it back on the formica, and Dorothy refilled it immediately.
You don't talk about it much.
What?
The war.
I nodded as she put the tan plastic pitcher on the counter next to me. I turned my glass in the circular imprint of its condensation. It's funny, but it came up earlier this afternoon. I met her eyes under the silver hair. Katie asked about the scar in my collarbone. The one from Ted. She nodded slightly.
Surely she's seen that before.
Yep. Dorothy took a deep breath.
It's okay. She's doing better every day.
She reached out and squeezed my shoulder just at said scar.
But be careful.
She looked concerned. I looked up at her.
Why? Visitations like those tend to come in threes.
I watched as she took the tea and refilled some of the other customers. I thought about Vietnam, thought about the smell, the heat, and the dead. Tan Son Nhut, Vietnam, 1967. I had flown in with them. A Spec 4 on the helicopter ride had asked where I was going and watched as I'd tried not to throw up on the dead that were stacked in the cargo area of the Huey. I wasn't sick because of the bodies. I'd seen a lot of those, I just didn't like helicopters. The men had been in a truck that had hit a mine, fire base support in the DMZ for Quezon. They were wrapped in plastic ponchos because the army had run out of body bags. They had run out of food, ammo, and medicine, too. The dead were one of the few things of which there always seemed to be plenty. The Spec 4 had shaken his head and told me not to worry. He said that if I got hurt, they could have me in a base camp hospital in 20 minutes. Real bad, and they would have me in Yokosuka, Japan, in 12 hours. He had gestured to the plastic-wrapped bundles behind him. Like them, they would have me home in a week. Later, I studied the chromate green interior of the Quonset hut as a lean Air Force investigative operations officer squinted up at me through his thick glasses and the sweat. He was studying my utility cap, so I yanked it off my head and returned to attention. I was sweating, too. Specifically, we were there to win over hearts and minds, but mostly what we did was sweat. I had been fighting the feeling that since arriving in Vietnam, coming up on 6 months earlier, I was melting. He made me wait the commensurate amount of time to let me know that I had performed a breach of military decorum with my cover and that the major was not pleased. What the hell am I supposed to do with you? The majority of the humidity in my body was draining between my shoulder blades and soaking the waistband of my fatigues.
Not sure, sir.
What the hell is a MOS-0111?
Marine Police, sir. Investigator.
He continued to shake his head. Yeah, I got the directive from MAF. Your papers cleared the provost marshal at Chu Lai, so I guess battalion headquarters has decided that you're my problem now. He looked up at me. He had the look I'd seen 1,000 times in the short period I'd been in country. He was old, an age
that had snuck up on him in the place would stay with him for the rest of his life. The event had him. The war was his religion, and his youth was gone with his eyes. Marine Inspector? I remained silent and focused on the corrugated wall in an attempt not to stare at the photo of Dee Dee Lind, Playboy's Miss August 1967, that was hung there. It was December. The Major looked back at my duty papers, rustling them in disbelief. Inspect? Hell, I didn't even know you jarheads could read. He flipped the page, and I figured the real trouble was about to begin. His eyes came up slowly. English, Major? Ball, sir. I'd found it best to downplay higher education in the armed forces, and football was always a quick and successful diversionary tactic. He blinked behind the glasses and frowned an acceptance that I might not be the complete wastrel he'd first imagined. Where'd you play? Offensive tackle, sir. The trenches? Outstanding. I played a little in high school. With a leather helmet, I figured. Is that right, sir? Halfback. Yes, sir. Backup, no doubt. He studied my papers some more. I didn't play much. I didn't know what to say to that, so I just stood there with my mouth shut, another method I'd learned in dealing with military hierarchy. Look, somebody owes somebody a favor, and that's why you're here. He leaned back in his green metallic chair, which almost matched the chromate walls, and finally remembered that I was still at attention. At ease. He dropped my papers and concentrated on me as I took a quarter step to the side and placed my hands behind my back. I was still holding my hat. We've got a little drug-smuggling problem on the base, but nothing big. We've already got some very good men working on the situation. I'm only guessing, but I'd say the provost marshal wants one of his brand-new MOS-0111s to get his feet wet. He continued to consider me, and I guessed that he wanted a response. Yes, sir. Why Mother Green and her mean machine can't police her own messes, of which there are plenty, is a mystery to me, but you're here, and we'll just have to make the best of things. He glanced back at the papers on his desk. You're new, and it won't take long for everyone to figure out why you're here, so the best thing you can do is keep your mouth shut and do what you're told. You got me? Yes, sir. All of the work you've done in the past has been under the direct supervision of Navy investigators. Now, however, you will be working with Air Force security personnel and Central Intelligence Detachment, who I am sure you will find infinitely more capable than the Swabos. Yes, sir. I'm putting you with Mendoza, who is our own 377th, and Baranski of Central Intelligence Division. They've been working the case for about 5 weeks, and you will provide the muscle. Yes, sir. If he belched, I was going to yes-er it. They're first Louis, and you will follow every order they give you. Understood? Yes, sir. They're class of 66. He slipped my papers back in the folder and handed them to me. That means there's one of you butter bars left. Gives great hope to the war effort. Yes, sir. Dismissed. When I got to the outer office and handed my folder to the airmen, there were two first lieutenants leaning against the doorway. One was short and dark. The other was a tall bon vivant with an Errol Flynn mustache. The tall one had blonde hair, Air Force blue eyes, and Army fatigues. He stuck his hand out and I shook it, taking in the casual, self-assured swagger of a man very content with himself. You are a new pet marine? Yep. He lit a camo cigarette and swiveled his head to look at his partner, who now extended his hand. I shook his as well. He spoke with a strong Texas accent. Mendoza. This here's Baranski. I had already read their names just above their right pockets, just as I was sure they'd already read mine, but it was now a different protocol. I slipped my hat back on. Longmire. Sheriff Longmire? I turned and looked up at Rosie Wayman, one of the few females in the Wyoming Highway Patrol. She'd been transferred up from the Elk Mountain Detachment about 6 months ago and had been causing quite a stir here in the Bighorns. Well, if it isn't the sweetheart of I-25. I watched as the trademark grin showed bright white teeth and her blue eyes sparked. Maybe my evening was looking up. I wondered when Vic would be back.
I'm sorry to bother you, Walt, but we got a call in, and Ruby said this would be where you were.
What have we got?
Some ranchers found a body down on Lone Bear Road near Route 249.
Maybe my evening wasn't looking up.
That was near Powder Junction. It was July, and it didn't take much deduction to figure out why the locals were out on that desolate part of the county road system.
Swathers or bailers?
Bailers. They supposedly swathed last week.
No square hectare of grass went unshorn in a Wyoming summer. The Department of Transportation usually subcontracted the cutting of grass along its motorways to the lowest bidding local ranchers, which allowed the state grass to become a private commodity, commonly known as beer can hay. I poked a thumb toward the blonde patrol person as Dorothy returned with a dish full of chicken and lemongrass.
Can I get that to go?
No matter what aspect of law enforcement with which you might be involved, there's always one job you dread. I'm sure at the more complicated venues it's the terrorists, it's serial killers or it's gang-related, but for the Western Sheriff, it's always been the body dump. To the north, Sheridan County has two unsolved, and Natrona County to the south has five. Up until 28 minutes ago, we'd had none. There you stand by some numbered roadway with a victim, no ID, no crime scene, no suspects, nothing. I got out of Rosie's cruiser and nodded to Chuck Freimeyer and Double Tough, my two deputies from the southern part of the county.
Walt, he's down over the hill.
We headed toward the giant balers at the edge of a large culvert. Lieutenant Cox, the Highway Patrol Division commander, were standing halfway down the hill toward the barrow ditch with two more of his men, still riding in their duty books. It was near their highway, but it was my county.
Hey, Carl.
Walt? He nodded at one of the pieces of equipment where two elderly cowboys sat, one in a beaten straw hat and the other wearing a rocking D Ranch ball cap. You know these gentlemen?
Yep.
The two got up when they noticed me. Den and James Dunnigan were a couple of hardscrabble ranchers from out near Bailey. James was a little wifty, and Den was just plain mean.
How you doing, James?
Den squinted and started in.
We swathed 2 days ago and she wasn't here, James cut him off. Hey, Walt.
What do we got? I figured the HPs had already gotten a statement from them, but I thought I'd give the brothers another shot at the story before we went any further.
Already told him.
Den gestured toward the HPs. It had probably been a long day. It was late on a Saturday afternoon, and he evidently felt they'd been detained long enough.
Tell me.
I remained conversational, but made sure it wasn't a question. Freimeyer had his notebook out and was scribbling. James continued in a soft voice and did his best to focus on the conversation at hand.
We was bailing and come up onto her.
What did you do?
He shrugged.
Shut her down and called 911.
Go near the body?
Nope, I didn't.
You sure?
Yep.
I glanced at Den, who was blinking too much.
Den?
He shrugged.
I went over to the edge of the culvert and yelled at her.
He blinked again.
I thought you might be asleep.
Then I saw she wasn't breathing. I had Den show me the exact route that he had taken. And then I retreated to the top of the culvert with my two deputies, where it was unlikely anybody had been. I squatted down in a hunter's crouch and listened as Cox dismissed the Dunnigan brothers.